So again, like, thank you very much. Actually, I'm speaking on behalf of my collaborator on this, Dr. Jürgen Renn, who very much regrets that he's the director, one of the directors of Max Planck Institute in Berlin, also with very strong ties to BU, and he very much regrets that he cannot be here himself. So basically, I'm presenting our talk on behalf of the both of us.
I'm not standing over here. So here is the abstract for the talk. So let me just give you a very quick idea what I want to talk about. So this is about how Einstein found his field equation, right? After all, that's what we're celebrating the centenary of. And there's some debate in the literature as to how he did this. Did he do this using physics predominantly or using mathematics predominantly? And Jürgen and I have been arguing that the role of the physics is much more important than the standard accounts. And if you believe that, and I'll show you the evidence why we believe this, there's this lecture that Einstein gave in September of 1913 that hasn't played a big role in reconstructions of Einstein's path to general relativity. It then becomes more important. So that's what I want to do. So essentially, this is a version of a paper that Jürgen and I wrote quite a while ago, and it was published in the Boston Studies. And you're in luck. First of all, you can get the volume now for only And second of all, you can also be the first to review the item. So this came out in 2007. Jürgen tells me this is one of the best-selling volumes in studies. It must be a lot of libraries with a lot of money. And it's based on this paper by the two of us called Untying the Knot, and I corrupted Jürgen, and so we used another quote from my great hero. So the picture is that Dylan was pretty much tangled up in blue for a long time, before he found all this. Now this is where the story ends up, and I'm working on a project now more general where I compare the development of physical theories as a process of arches being built on scaffolds. And so the question then is, you come upon this beautiful arch, and you ask yourself, how was this made? And so you can also do this when the arch happens to be a beautiful mathematical theory, and this is one. So these are the Einstein field equations, the way that Einstein wrote them. So on the left-hand side is something called a Ricci tensor that splits into two parts, an R and an S, and those are combinations of what John was mentioning, the Christoffel symbols that we'll encounter in the course of this talk. So remember this split, the details don't really matter. I'm trying to communicate this without assuming that you have working knowledge of the mathematics. And so, how did he build it? Well, we can first start to look at what the old sage had to say about this. I think my all-time favorite joke that I always use from John, that I always use with great success with my undergrads, is the most important myth about Einstein that he was born at the age of 15. But it's that guy, the older guy, who tells us what the younger guy was doing. So Einstein, in his autobiographical notes that he referred to as typical self-deprecation as my own obituary, written in 1949, he says, "I've learned something else from the theory of gravitation. No collection of empirical facts, no matter how comprehensive, can ever lead to the formulation of such complicated equations. They can only be found through the discovery of a logically simple mathematical condition that completely or almost completely determines the equations. Once one has those sufficiently strong formal conditions, one requires only little knowledge of facts to set up a theory." That's just very much emphasizing the mathematics and all of this. And the emblematic statement of this comes in a famous lecture that he gave in Oxford in March of 1933, where he says, "Newton still believes that the basic concepts and laws of the system could be derived from experience. A clear recognition of the erroneous of this notion really only came with the general theory of relativity, which showed that one could take account of a wider range of empirical facts in a more satisfactory and complete manner on a foundation quite different from the Newtonian." Sort of bypassing the fact that, of course, the introduction of field theory is a bit of a game changer. "If, then, it is true that the axiomatic basis of theoretical physics cannot be extracted from experience but must be freely invented, can we ever hope to find the right way?"
sense, right?
And then he continues to answer his question, and this is the most famous part of the lecture. I answer without hesitation that there is, in my opinion, a right way. Our experience hitherto justifies us in believing that nature is the realization of the simplest conceivable mathematical ideas. I am convinced that we can discover by means of purely mathematical constructions the concepts and the laws which furnish the key to the understanding of natural phenomena. Experience remains, of course, the sole criterion of physical utility of a mathematical construction. It's the only sense I agree with. But the creative principle resides in mathematics. In a certain sense, therefore, I hold it true that pure thought can grasp reality as the ancient played on Pythagoras. Now, in fact, what he said in the 30s and fits well with what he said in 1915. So if you look at the first of those four November communications of Einstein that culminate in the fourth one with the Einstein field equation, you see stuff that fits, you know, like I picked the mathematically most natural candidate. So he says, like in the intro, he says, I completely lost confidence in the field equations of limited covariance of the 1913 so-called Einstein-Grossmann or Entwurf outline theory, very much like motivated by the physics, and looked for a way that would constrain the possibilities in a natural manner. I was thus led back to the demands of general covariance, which I had abandoned with a heavy heart when I was collaborating with Grossmann. In fact, we only came very close. And then he says, hardly anybody who has truly understood the theory will be able to avoid coming under its spell. It's a real triumph of the method of the general differential calculus developed by Gauss, Riemann, Christoffel, Ricci, and Civita. After what has been said so far, it's natural to posit the field equations of the form, and there he still misses like one term, but it's close. Okay? So you see, this fits with what the guy told us in the 30s. And in fact, when he's claiming that he already got close like a few years earlier, that is also confirmed by archival evidence, the famous Zurich notebook. Here you see at the top, written Grossmann. Grossmann is handing him this tensor. This is the Ricci tensor. And one half of it, right, the same, remember he split it in two parts. One half, he says, this is the probable gravitation tensor. And so purely mathematical considerations had led him there. And as John was mentioning, in his remark in Q&A after his talk, he rejected them because he couldn't get them to work physically, right? They seemed to violate energy-momentum conservation, and they seemed not to reduce to the Newtonian theory in the appropriate limit. So, but these are exactly the equations that were resurrected, in the first November paper, and then it's a few more tweaks and you have the Einstein field equation. That first one is the big break. So, now you continue, right, you look at letters, and again, there seems to be, letters that confirm that there is this sharp turn from the physics to the mathematics around in the fall of 1915. And so these are very amusing letters. Einstein writes to Besso in December of 1915. He says, this time the obvious, and look at the Germany, das Nächstliegende, was correct. However, Grossmann and I believe that conservation law wasn't satisfied and laws would not come out. Now, so the obvious here is still in the mathematics. Right? Now, a year earlier, he wrote to Besso. He says, the general theory of invariance only proved to be an obstacle. The direct route was the only feasible one, right? This is the physics. The only thing that's incomprehensible is that I had to feel my way around for so long before I found the obvious. That's nature. Right? But of course, in this case, the obvious is the physics. Right? So what I've presented you is more and more evidence that confirms this kind of a standard picture most forcefully represented by the work of John Norton, that there is this sharp break from physics to mathematics in late 1915. But of course, you're waiting for the but. Okay? And there is a but. Björn and I believe that the preponderance of the evidence suggests just the opposite. And here is Einstein to just complicate matters, writing to Besso in 1918. He says, rereading your last letter, I find something that almost makes me angry, that speculation had proved itself to be superior to empiricism. You're thinking here about the development of relativity theory. I find that this development teaches something else, which is almost the opposite, namely that a theory, to deserve our trust, must be built upon generalizable facts. In the case of general relativity, equality of inertial and gravitational mass, never has a truly useful and profound theory really been found purely speculative. Right? This is the same guy that I just quoted in 1933. Right? Remember, right? This was the famous line. Now, if you look at that, even at that talk, there are a few disclaimers. So the disclaimer right at the beginning, which is very amusing, is the first sentence of the lecture. If you want to find out anything from the theoretical physicists about the methods they use, I advise you to stick closer to one principle. Don't listen to their words. Fix your attention on their deeds. And then he proceeds to tell you how he did. The other thing that is very telling is, he says, in the course of the lecture, the way in which a scientist working in some field regards its past and present may depend too much on what he hopes for the future and aims at in the present. And that, I think, is very true in this case. And again, like, you know, like an ad for the book of my countryman, Jeroen van Dongen, where basically, you know, these 1933 pronouncements, I think, should be seen as, like, not as a historically accurate account of how we found general relativity, but as a big advertisement for unified field theory. So, how did he actually find this field? Oh, this looks scary. So, this is like what the five of us, the authors of the book I showed you, worked on. Here we are in better days. This is really me. Here's Jürgen. The five of us also don't quite agree, but I think like John and Jürgen and I pretty much agree. I mean, the outlier here is John Norton. So what Jürgen and I argue in this paper is that Einstein found the field equations through an elaborate analogy with the field equation for the electromagnetic field in special relativity. Right? I mean, the language that I currently prefer, he built his arch on an elaborate scaffold. So the analogy of electromagnetism already played a role in a theory before he had even had the metric. It informed the derivation of these Edward field equations. It is given pride of place in his Vienna lecture, which is where that comes in. And it is central to the variational formalism that Einstein developed in 1914 for the Edward theory, and that was crucial to the breakthrough of November 1915 and the presentation of the theory in 1916. So we want to reevaluate, right, this Vienna lecture in the light of these views, in the light of the distinction between these two strategies, mathematical and physical. And so this is a big part of our book, so let me just quickly explain to you what we mean by mathematical strategy and physical strategy. So the mathematical strategy is that, you know, you extract some candidate of broad covariance from the Riemann curvature tensor, and then you think that that is going to meet, like, your philosophical desiderata in relativity and equivalence principle. Early this morning, I told you that some of that turns out to be illusory, right? But Einstein, of course, didn't know. Then you're going to check whether the physical requirements are met, right? And that's where he runs into trouble. Now, the physical strategy is just the reverse. You construct something in analogy with electrodynamics, right? The only, like, relativistic field theory you have. And so now you make sure that it meets the physical requirements, energy momentum conservation, Newtonian limit, and then you check whether that candidate has enough covariance left for it to serve to satisfy your philosophical desiderata. So the question is, what brought the breakthrough, right? So if you believe that Einstein switched from physical to mathematical strategy at the 11th hour, then you can forget about the Vienna lecture because it just turns out to be a big step in the wrong direction. Right? If, however, you believe that he was doggedly pursuing the physical strategy, right, and that the mathematical strategy mainly comes in to sort of convince him of a certain convergence here, now the Vienna lecture is a big step in what turns out to be the right direction, right? And it becomes more interesting to study that, which is what Jürgen and I intend to do, and I'll report some of our preliminary findings. But first I want to show you now what our story is about how Einstein found his field equations. So I'll do so in the most non-technical manner I'm capable of doing this, right? So you don't even need to worry about, like, many of the details you're seeing here. So you're using the analogy of the electromagnetic field, like Maxwell's equation written in relativistic form. So here it is. This F is the electromagnetic field. You have some divergence of this. You have a charge current density on the right-hand side, so the charge current density is going to generate some field. And this F, like, you know, breaks down into the usual, like, E's and B's for electric and magnetic field in this way. Details are unimportant. And what Einstein is doing is just he plays the same game. So now, like, on the left-hand side, you have the gravitational field. So this gamma, this is Einstein's notation. This is not the gamma of the affine connection. And on the right-hand side, you have now the sources of this field, right, which is the energy momentum denser of matter. And as John was already mentioning in response to a question, right, he is looking at the self-energy of the gravitational field, right? There's going to be a little t mu nu, which is going to give you the density of the gravitational field, right? So there's analogies and disanalogies, but, like, you know, he's pursuing this analogy. And the only thing that you really need to sort of remember is that this gestalt, right, that these field equations are, you know, some four divergences of the field, and you set that equal to the source. So Jürgen and Tilman Sauer, like, you know, worked this out, like, using, like, the concept of frames developed by, like, Minsky and others, and different settings. Okay. And I'm going to help myself to this, right? So this, but it's very much sort of Jung's way of thinking about this. All right. So now, like continuing the analogy, you want to know the relation between the field and the potential for the field. And so, you know, like in electromagnetism, right? If you have a simple electrostatic field, it's just the gradient of the potential gives you the electric field. A little more generally, it would be like this, and like you would, in terms of this F mu nu, you would write actually two terms, and again, this comma means like a derivative. So again, this is some combination of like derivatives of gradients. And Einstein is going to do the same thing. So he's going to use that gestalt, the field is the gradient of the potential, to say, okay, you know, like we have the metric tensor, that does double duty encoding the coronal geometry and like the gravitational potential. I'm going to take like the gradient of this as the gravitational field. John mentioned that too, right? And so in 1913, that's what he did. And basically, you know, this is not the only choice, right? You could also do a combination of these things. And in particular, which he did in 1915, like he picked this thing, the Christoffel symbols, which is a combination of three of those terms, right? Let that be the gravitational field. And so here it is again, right? So the 1913 choice, the 1915 choice. And here is what Einstein has to say about this. Basically what he says, like, you know, picking this, I won't read you the whole quote, picking this rather than that was a fateful prejudice. Right? And then he goes on to say in a letter, he says the key to the solution was to replace this by that. Right? So these are really sort of the smoking guns for Jürgen and my claim that it was like pursuing the physics that got it right. Now how did that work? Right? Einstein had developed like this variational formalism, right? So you can derive these field equations from an object called the Lagrangian, and then you have standard machinery to crank out like the field equations. And so the Lagrangian for the vacuum Maxwell equations is this gadget over here. And again, don't worry too much about the details, just notice that, you know, like you do something very similar. And the gestalt here is just that the Lagrangian is something like the field squared. Okay? That's how you exploit the analogy. And in this case, you know, you get the vacuum field equations. And for the case of the gravitational field, if you stick in into for field this thing, then you get the Edwardian equations. If you stick in this the Christoffel symbols, you get half the Ricci tensor, which is exactly the thing that Einstein introduces, like in that first paper in November 1915, and then he's a few tweaks away from like having the full Einstein field equations. All right, on to the Vienna lecture. So this is what, you know, what comes to mind. Right? Well, of course, we're talking about a little bit earlier, right? We're talking about the demise of the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, right? With the Roman Museum called Catanian. And so this is what Einstein is visiting like in 1913, just before the war, and the whole thing goes down. And Radetzky March is the title of a beautiful novel of Joseph Roth, where he just describes the pain of this double bond. Okay. So Einstein gives this plenary lecture on the present state of the problem of gravitation in September of 1913 at a meeting of the GDNA, it's nothing to do with DNA, it's the Gesellschaft Deutsche Naturforschung und Ärzte, the Society for German Natural Scientists and Physicians. And so a little bit about the run-up to this lecture. So in May he accepts the invitation. In early July, in early June, he publishes this Einstein-Grossmann theory. Then he starts working on the periodic motion of Mercury. He gets a visit by Nordström, who is working on a competing theory, a special relativistic theory that will play a role in my story later on. And in August of 1913, Einstein presents like an argument that energy momentum conservation restricts the covariance of these Edwardian equations all the way to linear transformation. And this is good news for Einstein at this point, because as he said, I abandoned general covariance with a heavy heart. Now he seems to have some argument why he could not have general covariance, because then that would be at odds with energy momentum conservation. Now, in August 21, he actually submits the manuscript for the lecture, right? This is good. Typically we don't submit manuscripts ahead of time. Later in August, there's a now famous memo that was found by Robert Schulman, by Besso, which interestingly has an embryonic version of the whole argument against Jericho variance that John was talking about. And what this, the nice thing about this memo is that there's a lot of, as John says, a lot of confusion about this. It shows that Einstein from the get-go was not confused about what he was doing, right? I mean, like his first three publications, like, you know, you could argue either way, but this sort of embryonic version has exactly the steps that, you know, you should, that should be there. Then he gets the page proofs and adds a footnote. He says, within the last few days, I found proof that there cannot be Jericho variant field equations. That's got to be a reference to the whole argument. All right, he goes there, staying with his in-laws. You know, this is right before, like, his marriage to Mileva Marić unravels, and then, you know, leaves her behind and goes to Vienna. And then delivers the lecture. So it's actually, like, we looked at some newspaper report, and it's actually, like, reported, like, in various newspapers in Vienna. Right? And so here, you know, like it's announced, the problem of gravitation by Professor Einstein. And so here is the article about it. And, you know, saying, like, well, meets them everywhere in the city, the German scientist and physician, and one is happy to run into them, a whole army equipped with curious weaponry, scalpels, microscopes, and tubes. And so here's the Arbeiter Zeitung, yeah, the workers' paper. And they have some interesting gossip. They say, like, just a year ago, Einstein was working at the University of Prague. From there, he moved to Zurich, and now he's leaving for Berlin. There, he received a so-called academy professorship. This means that he can devote himself completely to his research without losing most of his time to teaching and exams. In Austria, something like this is impossible, of course. So here is the, in the Neue Freie Presse, they even, like, have, like, a summary of the lecture, which is a slightly reworded version of the introduction to the lecture. And Jürgen and I, when we saw it, got quite excited. Wow, we've discovered, like, a new Einstein text, because clearly only Einstein, you know, seemed to have been able to write this. And what we thought, like, was really a sort of a tip-off. In the lecture, he says, Maxwell's theory was replaced actually at a distance by partial differential equations, which, of course, would mean nothing to the reader of the newspaper. In the newspaper, it's replaced by an action from point to point. That's a clever substitution. Unfortunately, there's also a big argument against it, because Einstein would not have confused thermodynamics and electrodynamics. So probably it's not an Einstein text. So here is the intro. I'm not going to read this to you. The only thing that's important about it is that this intro is all about electrodynamics, right? It's about talking about, like, well, how do we get, once you have Coulomb's law, how would we have gotten to, like, Maxwell's law? So he uses that to motivate the entire procedure. And so here's the structure of the lecture, right? He says, well, you know, like, we're going to look at four requirements: energy momentum conservation, quality of inertial gravitational mass, covariance, but only under linear transformation, and some other, like, you know, technical constraint that is not that important for my purposes. Now, there are two theories that satisfy these requirements. There's this Owen and Worth theory, and there is this Nordström theory. In question time, he gets called on this by Gustav Mie, who has his own theory. He said, why did you talk about mine? Well, that theory does not respect this, right? So Einstein is not interested. And so the Vienna lecture, like, really nicely illustrates, like, Einstein's methodology when he was a younger man, right? Where he's, like, takes a very different approach. So this is from his inaugural lecture in Berlin in 1914, where he explains how, like, a theorist operates. The theorist's method involves his using as his foundation general postulates or principles from which he can deduce conclusions. And he says, well, finding the principles is the hard part, right? Once you have those, you know, like, any monkey can do, like, you know, the deductive reasoning. How do you find these principles? The scientist has to warn these general principles out of nature by perceiving in comprehensive complexes of empirical facts certain general features which permit a precise formulation. And this is, I think it's a very nice formulation, but it's also, like, uncharacteristically sort of clunky. But I mean, Einstein is a very elegant writer, so, like, I think he put a lot of thought into getting here precisely what he wants to say here. So I want to emphasize that there are then three criteria that need to be met by these principles, only two of which he mentioned explicitly here, right? So first of all, they need to be grounded in comprehensive complex of empirical facts, right? So it's not true that Einstein doesn't care about empirical facts, right? The famous story, you know, he gets the eclipse expedition. Professor Einstein, what would you have done if the results had been different, right? And Einstein is saying, like, I would have felt sorry for the dear Lord. The theory is correct anyways. Okay? So now that makes for a good story, but it's not true. Einstein is concerned about, like, you know, the empirical data. He just doesn't care about what happens in the third decimal place. and he's typically right about that, right? Their things are not so clear. Of course, like in something like, you know, the equality of inertial and gravitational mass, that's important to him. Then, of course, they need to be able to, you know, you need to be able to precisely formulate this so you can do something with it. And the other thing that he doesn't say here explicitly, but it's clear from the context, that it has to characterize really the theory that you're after. Because like in quantum theory, he's doing a similar sort of stuff where he's using principles like the Boltzmann's principle and like equipartition, but he would not call this a theory, right? Because he doesn't think that those principles are characteristics for the quantum theory that he's looking for. In this case, he thinks he got it. Relativity principle, equivalence principle, that's the theory. All right, back to the Vienna lecture. So the lecture was followed by a very lively discussion. As I already mentioned, Mie complains. Reissner raised a very interesting issue that Jürgen and I are still looking at. So how exactly are you going to recover the equality of inertial and gravitational mass now that mass essentially has been replaced by the energy-momentum tensor? Right, that's the source of the gravitational field that then, you know, like also should be representing like the mass. How are you going to do this? Right, and a very interesting issue that Einstein does not, you know, like have an adequate response to at the time. So he actually writes a paper in response to Reissner and apologizes in that paper that he had misunderstood the question. He writes a response to me, and like he writes like a paper with Fokker, like the Dutch Adrian Fokker, student of Lorentz, who is on this competitive theory. Right? In the Vienna lecture, you know, remember, like he gives about equal time to both his own theory and his Nordström theory. So you know, this kind of changes the picture of sort of the lone genius that gets to general relativity to, like, you know, what Jürgen likes to call like the Vienna circle, right, of like people like collaborating with him. Right, so like I'll read you one more report, one more sentence from this report in the Neue Freie Presse, like Vienna newspaper. It says, lonely are these scholars, and in earlier centuries they probably would have remained lonely. The voice of one would not have reached the other. Now they're sitting together in parliament and deliberate about the laws governing the revolutions of the stars. And so if you just make up a list of people contributing to the genesis of general relativity, you see that this picture of like Einstein doing it all by himself gets like qualified quite a bit. Of course, there's Grossmann, there's Besson, Nordström, Lauer, Reissner, Mie, Kotler, who like does important work in reformulating Maxwell's equations in this, sort of Minkowski four-dimensional form, which is very important for Einstein, and Einstein has never met Kotler, and during the lecture actually asked Kotler, who was from Vienna, to stand up and be recognized. Right? And then there's like Bernays, who like suggested to look at the variational formalism. I mentioned Freundlich, right, in earlier this morning, like about like astronomical confirmation and Fokker. Right? Now, I don't want to exaggerate the point, right? I mean, it's not like a collaborative effort the way that quantum mechanics, like in the 20s, is a collaborative effort with like Heisenberg, Born, Jordan, Pauli, Schrodinger, right? I mean, like Einstein is clearly like the powering figure in this, right? But these people do make important contributions. So, I want to look at Einstein's response to me, because like what you get from me is that Einstein now thinks about like the field equations in a very particular way, and so the field equations are like some generally covariant equation plus what we call like a coordinate restriction. Okay? Now we call it a coordinate restriction rather than a condition. A coordinate condition is kind of a gauge condition, right? You write down generally covariant field equations. You want to compare them with Newton's theory. But Newton's theory is not written in general covariant form, so you need to restrict the general covariant equations to some sort of coordinate system before you can compare. Right? Now, that condition is like immaterial to the theory, right? Different problem, different coordinate condition, right? Einstein doesn't operate that way. And again, there's disagreement in our group whether he operates that way because he didn't understand general coordinate conditions yet, which is Jürgen in my view, or whether he chose to do it this way for other reasons, which is particularly like John Norton's view. So, but everybody agrees the way he's working it is he uses the same coordinate condition for all problems. So it becomes like an integral part of the theory, which is important here because, like, remember, because of the whole argument at this point, he believes there are no generally covariant field equations. Those are simply impossible. So you need to restrict those by putting on some other condition. And so the beauty of that is that then the covariance of the field equation is determined by the covariance of this coordinate restriction, which is typically a much simpler expression to investigate. And you see, already see Einstein do this in the Turing Novel. So here is the quote from me. You know, this it would take way too long to argue. I mean, this is a complicated passage to argue one way or the other. This is how Jürgen and I read it. Now he's going to work with Fokker on the Nordstrom theory, and he is going to do exactly that. Write the field equation of the Nordstrom theory as a generally covariant equation plus a coordinate restriction. And roughly the field equation, right, the equation I start from, is which is now seen the field equation for the Fokker theory, for the Nordstrom theory, is just taking like the Riemann curvature scalar and set that equal to the trace of the energy momentum tensor, right? So I did try to just suppress the indices. This is after you sum over all these indices, right? So this equation looks a lot like what Einstein has, but Einstein has like this mu on both sides. And then, you know, there is like a condition that the metric is in modern terms is conformally flat, which means that it can be written in the form that you have some field times like, you know, a simple constant diagonal metric that gives the constant metric and the constant spacetime structure of Minkowski spacetime. And so the thing, the field, is going to be this gadget, and that's exactly the field that Nordstrom had written his theory in earlier. And so Einstein and Fokker, in their conclusion, he says, it was shown that one can arrive at Nordstrom's theory by purely formal considerations, right? You look at the at this Riemann-Christoffel tensor, and then you just, like, you know, you write up this, right? And they suggest, like, well, we should try to do the same thing for the Einstein-Grossmann theory, for the Accord theory. Which is what Einstein and Grossmann then set out to do in a second paper they published called Covariance-Eigenschaften, Covariance Properties, that they do in late 13, early 14, just before Einstein leaves Turing for Berlin. So this is the structure they want. Like, can we find this field equation by starting with some generally covariant equation and adding a coordinate restriction? And so what Einstein and Grossmann are able to find is they find the coordinate restriction, but they don't find the generally covariant equations that correspond to them. But, you know, no harm done, because those are uninteresting. You know, these are the half the field equation, the half the restriction. And they then see that this restriction actually does double duty. It not only determines the covariance group of the Endwurf field equation, it also guarantees, like, energy momentum conservation. So this is, like, in fact, like, you know, an example of the Noether theorem avant la lettre, and this is, like, you know, what motivates, like, people in Göttingen, like, to look into this problem, which is then solved by Emmy Noether. And you know, Catherine has written some beautiful papers on, like, you know, like, on how this came out. And so this new coordinate restriction then replaced that rather crude argument of Einstein's in August 1913 that energy momentum conservation reduces it all the way to, like, linear transformations. It's now a little more subtle. And Besso, his friend, like, who typically is sort of a you know, very confusing writer, clearly recognized the progress here, right? So he says, like, you already have the fundamental insight that the conservation laws represent the condition for positing an admissible coordinate system. But it did not appear to be ruled out that the restriction to Lorentz transformation, linear transformations, was thereby essentially already given, so that nothing interesting epistemologically comes out. Now everything is fundamentally completely satisfied. So they're very happy about, like, how where they are now. Right? And so Einstein now, like, in October 1914, he's going to write a review article on this theory, right? In hindsight, of course, highly premature. And he replaces, instead of, like, an outline of a generalized theory, the paper's now called The Formal Foundation of the General Theory. Okay? And so Einstein now convinces himself that covariance considerations lead uniquely to the Lagrangian for the Endwurf field equations, right? The one I showed you before, right, that in later he would call, like, a fatal prejudice. And he now made the same claim that he and Fokker made for the Nordstrom theory, so we have now, in a completely formal manner, i.e. without direct use of our physical knowledge about gravity, arrived at a very definite field equations. Now, I want to point out that this is an overstatement of the fact, right? I mean, there's lots and lots of physical considerations coming in, but you can sort of understand Einstein's excitement at this point that now everything seems to fit, right? Everything, like, he now has a theory that has just sort of, you know, fits the gestalt that he has in mind, that he'd found for Nordstrom, now he has found it for the Endwurf theory as well. So this is that you can understand that he now goes into print, writes this lengthy review article doing all of that. Unfortunately, you know, the whole thing, like, comes apart quickly, like, a few months later. Einstein writes, discovers that whole uniqueness argument is just illusory. You know, you can write down many, many Lagrangians, that satisfies these the constraints that he has. So that was a setback, but it was also an opportunity, right? And the opportunity is that it allowed Einstein to consider alternative Lagrangians. And so, but he had this whole system in place, right, that I showed you earlier with this formalism, right? This is very important to make sure that, I mean, one of the beauties of Lagrangian formalism is that you have a real good handle on energy conservation that was problematic earlier. So he wants to keep that whole edifice in place, right? And he sees, like, okay, what can I tinker with? And it's not hard to imagine that one of the first things that he would try is, well, you know, we can change the definition of the gravitational field in a rather obvious way, because in fact, like, if you look at, you know, how these things, like, occur in these equations, it would have been more natural to stick with this Christoffel simple thing in the first place. So he keeps this, but then just replaces this thing, the fateful prejudice, by the Christoffel symbols, right? And so now, like, these Edworth equations, right, and more specifically, like, the variational formalism developed for them in analogy with electromagnetism, then become the scaffold for the arts that we started with, right? Because now we recognize, oh, if I do that, then I get, like, you know, the stuff that I recognize from Riemannian geometry, and I can forget about, like, all this analogical reasoning. Right, that's the story. So now, like, and this is the last slide. Just look at the introduction of the November paper again, right? Remember, like, what he said, I completely lost confidence, right? But he lost confidence in this one bit of it, right? He kept this whole structure in place. I was thus led back to the Mendel more general covariance, right? Once he makes that change, like, he gets something that has a much broader covariance than the Edworth equation, and that, you know, like raises, like, other puzzles, right? And now he's going to, you know, this is what the title of our original paper, but now he's going to, like, untie this knot, right? And then the tangle of the blue fuzz is over. And then, you know, like, once he is there, right, hardly anybody was truly understood the theory, blah, 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 will avoid coming under its spell. And then, you know, like, right at the end, he says, after what has been said so far, it is natural to posit these field equations. Okay? So whereas before, right, you read this, hope, right, to have conviction, but whereas before you read this as, like, you know, he erects this, like, beautiful arch without any scaffolding, that now what you're seeing is that, in fact, like, what he's doing is, like, hiding, in that sense, it's like the scaffolding that he's just been able to discard, because, like, you know, he has now arrived at this new theory. Thank you.